Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. I'm John Iderola. Gigantic show today, packed full of guests. Not only do we have Emma Vigeland, who's going to be joining us to break down some of the news of the day in just a little bit, one of my favorite people to just talk about politics with. We've got her on a number of different important topics, including Donald Trump attacking Greta Thunberg. That should be a lot of fun. Let's see, we've got Joe Biden shopping around talking points to attack Medicare for All with. The Washington Post claims that Bernie Sanders has stolen his wealth tax plan. We're going to break down the facts behind that. We've got an activist from the Sunrise Movement. We've got Representative Ro Khanna on primarying Democrats. We've got impeachment, the argument that Donald Trump secretly wants to be impeached. He wants to be investigated. What does Donald Trump think about that? Some footage from a few years back, very interesting stuff there. But before we get to all that, and that is a ton to get to, we want to start off with a couple of quick updates on the situation with Donald Trump, a phone call, a whistleblower, and Ukraine. Depending on what day it is, Donald Trump has had a number of different excuses for what actually transpired on his phone call with Ukraine. The withholding of aid, the investigation of Joe Biden. At various points, he either knew he'd be listened to or has no idea who this person is and wonders if they're some sort of agent against the United States. They did send Giuliani to investigate Biden. They didn't send him to investigate Joe Biden. And today there's a new one, actually. So as he's off at the UN, he has come up with a new explanation as to why he, in new reporting, did hold the aid a week before his phone call with the new leader of Ukraine. Let's take a look.
Why did you hold aid a week before your call with the Ukrainian president?
Because very important, very important. I want other countries to put up money. I think it's unfair that we put up the money. Then people called me, they said, oh, let it go, and I let it go. But we paid the money. The money was paid. But very importantly, Germany, France, other countries should put up money. And that's been my complaint from the beginning.
Okay, had nothing to do with Joe Biden. It was just about money. They wanted to make sure that other people ponied up money too. That is why it was so suspiciously timed around the phone call and the questions that he is not even remotely denying that he did concerning Joe Biden and all that. That's why he continues every time he's asked about this to again try to divert attention to Joe Biden. That's why all of that's been going on, because he's just worried about the financial obligations of other countries. So look, it's not a good sign for Donald Trump that it took them like 5 days to come up with this. It's not the worst excuse. If you're trying to create plausible deniability, if you're trying to create just a little bit for like for your followers, for your defenders in the media to hide behind, there are worse things, because he says there, that's my only concern. That's the only concern I've ever had, is other countries ponying up money. Then he can tie to literally years and years of him saying in regards to NATO funding that he's been pushing for them to put in more money. So that isn't the worst excuse he could come up with. It's fairly pathetic considering all that they've already admitted. And that's the thing, by the way, on this update and on any other updates that might be coming in the next few days on this show, updates about what the Dems want to see before they move forward on impeachment, updates on talking points from the right-wing media about Donald Trump and what actually happened in regards to Ukraine. I don't care about any of that, any of the explanations as to why he did the phone call. Since we found out about it, he has admitted in public a number of times, him and Rudy Giuliani, everything that we need to know. We don't have in one sentence the quid pro quo, but we have it all laid out for us. And only a complete dullard wouldn't be able to see it or acknowledge it at this point. And they're hoping that our country is full of those sorts of people. They are hoping that if they just kick up a little bit of sand, if they muddy the waters just a little bit, then people will back off. And they'll say once again, yeah, I guess he broke some laws, but I don't know. Joe Biden's probably corrupt too. And I heard something about Hunter Biden. And honestly, I don't want to get invested in it. You know, first of all, there's probably not going to be any consequences. And so I don't want to invest more of my psyche, more of my life force into this. And I understand that inclination. I understand how draining the past couple of years have been. But this is not complex. Their cover story has been debunked. Not the entirety of it. Hunter Biden almost certainly benefited from Joe Biden being his father. And this would hardly be the first time that wealthy, well-connected, politically influential people in the United States had used their power to benefit their families. But what did not happen is the cover story that we are hearing to try to deflect onto concerns about corruption in Ukraine. Yeah. You think that Donald Trump, all of a sudden, his prime concern was how corrupt Ukrainian government is? That could have been any random string of words and it would be as accurate. That's not on his list of concerns. And so it's a ridiculous thing to hide behind. We also have the transcript, of course. We didn't show you the full video there, but he talks about, you know, you'll see how perfect and fine the phone call was when the transcript comes out, because it'll probably come out. First of all, if it was, you know, if it was going to cover you as well as you're implying it would, you wouldn't be vacillating every 5 minutes on whether or not you're actually going to release it. But as I've said before earlier this week, I don't care what is on the transcript. First of all, I don't trust transcripts coming out of this White House. We know before, we've seen the video of Donald Trump having ridiculous slips of the tongue or saying something offensive. And then when the transcript of the meeting or the report or the gathering comes out, it's been whitewashed away. We've seen that happen before, so we can't discount the possibility that that would happen here as well. But more importantly than that, the whistleblower's initial complaint was not about one call, one transcript, one comment, one sentence. It was about 8 or 9 different things that gave them pause, that made them believe that Donald Trump was literally breaking the law, moving beyond his authority as president in pressuring a foreign government to aid him in his reelection efforts. I would love to have the Dems interview that whistleblower if it wasn't being blocked by the Trump administration, a Trump administration that believes and says that they have nothing to hide. Always doing a lot of hiding while they're saying that though. But the transcript itself, I don't really care about that. And I think that a lot of Dem leadership, I think that what they're doing is using that to make you sort of forget about the story, to believe that, well, okay, they're not doing anything, but once it comes out, they will. And so, you know, maybe that'll happen in a day or in a week or in a month. Maybe we'll get even closer to the election. Maybe people will stop paying attention to this story as they've stopped paying attention to so many things that should have been the end of the story. I think that's what this is all about. Now that said, I do want to turn to a slightly different part of this conversation. And so let's turn now to Fox News actually and Fox and Friends. Has Donald Trump lost Steve Doocy? Okay, I don't know for sure, but from today's Fox and Friends, the cover story that keeps changing about what exactly happened vis-a-vis Donald Trump and Ukraine, it doesn't seem to have convinced all three of the friends. And so here's a section from this morning's episode.
I have no problem with the timing. To me, the timing makes total sense. Before I meet with the new president, who's been a comedian, and he comes out of nowhere, I'd like to know that before you get your $400 million, you're going to do a few things, and I want to pressure our allies in the interim, Mr. OMB director and chief of staff, to pony up some money. After all, Russia's more of a threat to Western Europe than they are to the United States.
But it's like saying, Brian or Steve, you're going to lose your job because of a conversation that someone says you promised someone, but we don't know what you said. We don't know what the conversation was. It's ridiculous. They're putting their feet in front of too far ahead of what we need to just breathe. We need to take a step back. We need to maybe read this transcript, find out what was said, and then decide. Decide on impeachment. Right. They're meeting today at 4 o'clock to talk about impeachment.
Right, because if the president said, you know, I'll give you the money, but you got to investigate Joe Biden, that is really off the rails wrong.
Right.
But if it's something else, you know, it would be nice to know what it is. Mark Levin says right now, at this point, the media and Democrats are in panic mode.
Yes, because he's a hack. The idea that like, oh, Donald Trump might have used the influence of the most powerful single political office in the world to influence a foreign country to investigate a political rival. I'm in a panic over it. That's what's going on. But yeah, it's state TV. What do you expect at this point? So I want to run through all three of them really quick. Snap, crackle, and pop. So first you have Kilmeade. Of course they're going to want someone to do a few things. Yeah, bozo, it matters what those things are, okay? If we're giving them hundreds of millions of dollars and we expect them to, you know, like stop cracking down on a marginalized group inside of their country, that's the sort of influence that we're okay with. Our money is supposed to buy something. Maybe it should, for, you know, every once in a while, buy something positive for the world. That's one thing. Using it for your sole political benefit inside of one election, that is not an acceptable use of taxpayer money. It's not even Donald Trump's money. That would be corrupt enough. This is our money. And so using vague language, that's not gonna save you in this case, Kilmeade. I believe it's Ainsley Earhart. She says, you know, we don't even know what was said at this point. And how concerned does she seem to be about finding out what was said? That's what I love about the attempt to distract. It's always like, well, oh, you think this thing is bad? Well, what about that thing? Which isn't to say we should apply the same level of scrutiny and concern to both. It's that we should ignore one because something, something the other. And in this case, We don't know what was said, and how could we possibly ever find out? Scientists have debated it. I don't think they're ever gonna figure it out, so we should probably just move on to a different topic. No, your job is not to sit there and talk directly to the president. I mean, that's literally what your job is. That shouldn't be what the job of a member of the media is. You should want to know what was said on that phone call during Giuliani's meeting. All of the contextual information needed to know how serious this is. Was something illegal actually done? You can't just say, who knows, okay? You should want to know. You should be pushing for it. And considering that you basically have the status of a White House aide at this point, it would be nice if you did. And Ducey there said, if he did actually do a quid pro quo, that would be really bad. He used different wording, but that's what he said. And so that's about as critical as Fox and Friends ever gets to the president, especially considering the president is definitely watching at that time. Now, let's not jump ahead of ourselves on the Ducey thing, because Ducey is also attempting to set expectations there. He's saying, if he did a quid pro quo, I'll give you the money if you do this, that is attempting to move the goalposts. The idea that corruption has to be laid out in 140 characters for it to be an issue, that is insane. That is not how this whole thing is supposed to go. We're concerned if influence was used to attain corrupt ends. That's what we want to know. We don't want to know if it was in like a haiku form. We don't care about the format or how quick it was. We care about whether it was actually done, and hopefully we will find out about that. And bear in mind, again, they have already admitted it since this story came out a few days ago. Okay, so those are your updates. We're gonna take a short break. When we come back, Emma Vigeland's gonna be joining us. We're gonna be talking about climate change. We're gonna be talking about Medicare for all and more after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So when it comes to Greta Thunberg, all Donald Trump needed to do was not say anything, stay out of it, and you would have come across, not as a bigger man necessarily, but like as a well-socialized 12-year-old. But unfortunately, that was a bar that Donald Trump could not reach. And so instead he tweeted this, retweeting some of her powerful video from yesterday at the UN. He said, she seems like a very happy young girl looking forward to a bright and wonderful future. So nice to see. That's our president. That's the most powerful person in the world. And joining us now to comment, Rebel HQ's Emma Vigeland. Emma, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John. And if you didn't know this, she updated her Twitter bio to reflect that very sentiment that Trump espoused.
I noticed. Let's go to that now.
Yeah.
Let's bring that up. And her new status is a very happy young girl looking forward to a bright and wonderful future. Because she is both more mature and far more clever than Donald Trump could ever hope to be. So Emma, this is a pointless question, I'm sure, but scale of 1 to 10, Donald Trump sarcastically slamming a 16-year-old activist. How shocked are you?
I'm not shocked at all. The right wing has gone to great lengths to attempt to discredit this wonderful human being, including Laura Ingraham, comparing her to children of the corn, and her being basically attacked by the Ben Shapiro mini-me on Fox News the other night, where he was calling her mentally ill because she's been diagnosed with Asperger's. She has OCD and selective mutism, which she has called her superpower because it's given her the ability to be singularly focused on the issue of climate change. And for me, I see that it's given her the ability to cut out all the riffraff and just focus on what's important, which is saving the planet. I see this her superpower as well, and I'm incredibly moved by her every time I hear her speak. I'm having difficulty not crying just talking about her in this segment with you, John.
Yeah. No, I understand that. Her speech was very powerful. I get made fun of sometimes because of how often I say that I sort of draw my ability to keep doing this job on a day-to-day basis very often from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Greta Thunberg's very helpful too in that same respect. And so, look, you mentioned Michael Knowles of the Daily Wire called her a mentally ill Swedish child on Fox News. Now, they've said they're not going to have him on again in the future, but bear in mind that they had him on to say that after he had already tweeted that same phrase and said it about her on his own show, because right-wing commentators are very clever people, and when they found a great line, they hammer it into the ground. But we also have Laura Ingraham, who compared Greta Thunberg and youth climate activist to Stephen King's Children of the Corn for some reason. And so, look, I get that they're going to disagree with her, obviously, and they're gonna hate how influential she is. But the viciousness, the way that they're responding, it seems to me like this would be counterproductive. Do you disagree?
Of course, but this is who they are. There's no bottom to that barrel. And of course, Fox News is condemning what he's saying now, but they're gonna just quietly not have him on for a few weeks, and then he'll continue writing opinion pieces for FoxNews.com and will definitely appear on another show at some point, because the Daily Wire is inexplicably semi-successful. We can't take away that aspect from Ben Shapiro, although I can make fun of him and I will continue to.
We will do that.
Yes, so they will continue having him on at some point, but it goes to show that his comments were so egregious that Fox News felt the need to condemn. But at the time, they're probably going to quietly shuffle him back onto the show. The right wing has no moral argument when it comes to Greta Thunberg. They just basically have to make fun of her, and it comes off pretty badly because she's a 16-year-old child.
Yeah, I think you could have ended that sentence as they have no moral argument. So one related topic that's come up this morning. So as they're getting attacked for viciously attacking a 16-year-old, the response from the right is, this is the exact same thing that you guys did to the Covington kids. What do you think about that argument?
Do I have to dignify it? I mean, it's like ridiculous. Yeah, of course not. Of course, that's not exactly what was happening at all. Those children were also antagonistic towards those Native leaders. Now, there have been different reports that have come out about it, whatever. But this is all an effort, like all of these talk of her being mentally ill, the talk of her being a children of the corn, these vicious things that they're saying, the whataboutisms with the Covington kids. What about the issue of climate change? Are you guys gonna talk about that?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm even frustrated by some on the left, like Amy Klobuchar tweeting out the gif of her staring down Donald Trump, Greta Thunberg. Your plan doesn't really address any of the systemic and grave problems of climate change. It's the very incrementalist approach that Greta Thunberg is so angry at. So we have to look beyond her as a person. We have this issue in society where we can only see the face and not the words that are coming out of their mouth. She doesn't care about being famous. She doesn't care about being talked about herself. She purely cares about ending the climate crisis, and that is what makes her a superhero, and that's her superpower in this movement.
I couldn't agree more. Let's turn to another topic in the news this morning. I found it to be frustrating. I think that you might as well. Bernie Sanders has come out with his wealth tax proposal. It's a very interesting plan. We're gonna give you details, but did you know that he stole it from Elizabeth Warren? That's what the Washington Post is saying. Let's take a look at this tweet. Sanders, taking a page from Warren, proposes sweeping wealth tax. And then let's see, we also have the New York Times saying, with the proposal, Mr. Sanders is embracing an idea that has been a centerpiece of the campaign of his top progressive rival, Senator Elizabeth Warren. But while Ms. Warren came first, Mr. Sanders is going bigger. So they do admit that his plan is bolder. The issue is that, of course, Bernie Sanders has been pushing this sort of idea, a wealth tax, for a very long time in 2014, but he's been talking about it for more than two decades at this point. What did you think about this?
So, did you know that Bernie was not in favor of taxing the rich before this campaign? Apparently. I mean, it's only what he's been hammered about, or hammered, what the the mainstream media and the establishment has been hammering him for decades and decades and calling him a crazy loon. So it's absurd to suggest that he in some way stole this from Elizabeth Warren. Now, his plan is much more comprehensive than Elizabeth Warren's, but I do think that Elizabeth Warren's proposal is, I've said for a while, politically perfect in the sense that it seems very reasonable to the average voter, the 2% and 3% off the top for the billionaires and for the wealthiest people in this country, to fund all of these significant programs. People hear that and they go, wow, but Bernie's plan goes further. And what's irritating is that the Washington Post couldn't just frame this as, oh, he has a more radical or more progressive or a more all-encompassing wealth tax plan. No, it's that he took it from Elizabeth Warren when he's been espousing these ideas for decades as a member of the House and now as a senator. And so he got the political ramifications of the establishment going after him in the past for these proposals. But now that they've become mainstream, he doesn't even get the credit. And now they're saying he's taken it from someone else when that's patently absurd.
Yeah, and incredibly frustrating. I mean, we've seen this throughout the primary. They oppose his plans right up until the point where, come on, Bernie, stop talking about how you came up with it. Everybody agrees. So that's a frustrating turn. On the flip side, you know, I'm not one of the people that thinks that Elizabeth Warren has simply stolen all of his plans. I think that they have similar sorts of goals that they come at from different directions. And I think that almost uniformly, his plans are better, his goals are better and bolder. And to that end, let's just briefly show a comparison of the wealth tax proposal. You can see that down at the bottom, Elizabeth Warren, between $50 million to $1 billion wealth. She has a 2% tax plan over $1 billion, it's 3%. And you can see there that there's both a more fine-grained, granular approach in Bernie Sanders' plan, but also far higher amounts that in the end would end up raising more than twice as much. And what's really interesting, I'm gonna jump ahead. Bernie got a lot of, he got attacked today for saying he doesn't think billionaires should exist. We can talk about that in just a sec. But Warren Gunnels tweeted, if Bernie's plan had been in place from the early 80s to today, take a look at how much some of the most noteworthy billionaires would be worth. Bezos would be worth $43 billion rather than $160. Gates, $9.9 instead of $97 billion. Those are amazing. And I know that for some billionaires, that's horrifying. But note that you would still never be able to spend every dollar that you have if you had those smaller amounts.
Well, I know one thing for sure. Billionaires are quiet folk, and they're certainly going to take this very well. Mm-hmm. And not have any opposition in the form of bribes. Campaign contributions to bolster that view.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know that they're gonna be taking another look at Biden and Kamala and Buttigieg and all that because this is gonna scare the hell out of them. It is possible that if they feel like the alternative, it's either this, which is doomsday, or what is would previously have seemed unimaginable, which would be Warren's plan. It is possible that they would prefer that, but we'll have to see how the donations shake out in the near future.
I would love if that were the choice. Oh my God, would I love if that were the choice? And they would have to take a wealth tax from Warren's perspective, or the bolder and more comprehensive wealth tax from Bernie's perspective and Bernie's campaign. That would be a phenomenal choice for the rest of us.
That certainly would be. Emma, I wish that we had more time. I know we had some more topics we want to talk about, but unfortunately we're running over. So thank you as always for joining us. It's great to have you on.
Thanks so much, John.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, we're gonna be turning to climate change after this. On the issue of our climate crisis, we are currently at what I would say is a boiling point. Not just, you know, in terms of the actual effect on the climate, but also in terms of our conversation about it. Lots of people are paying attention to this right now. There's the very real chance that if the 2020 election goes the right way, significant action could finally be taken. And so what we have been doing here at the Damage Report is profiling some of the young activists who have been helping to get us to this point. It's been very long, hard fought throughout this year, pushing for a Green New Deal, for politicians who are gonna take this issue seriously. And so that effort continues today. We're joined by Zena Precht Rodriguez, activist with the Sunrise Movement. Zena, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. So tell me a little bit about this year, about working with the Sunrise Movement. There are a lot of groups that have been involved in this effort, but obviously Sunrise Movement has been one of the most important, one of the most influential since the most recent push started late last year. What has that experience been like for you?
Well, it's been absolutely a whirlwind. Ever since November, when we sat in at Pelosi's office, all of a sudden we were at the center of the debate when it came to climate change and climate politics. So I joined on the team full time in June, and right away off the bat, we knew that we were going to be pushing for the Democratic candidates to be having a climate debate. And so I joined team, I went to boot camp, and about 2 weeks in, I was sleeping outside of the DNC headquarters in Washington, D.C., demanding that the DNC sanction a climate debate and commit to holding one. And that was an entire process in itself. We gained victory. We had two different forums on a climate debate, and now we're going straight into striking and mobilizing millions of people to disrupt business as usual and force our politicians to take climate action. So it's been quite a journey.
It certainly has. And as you pointed out, there have been some great successes along the way. Originally, there weren't going to be any climate focused events in this debate. Now there have already been multiple. There are likely to be more here at TYT. We're helping to organize one right now. But I'm curious, you know, considering your acknowledgement of the crisis we're facing, your expectations in terms of what needs to be done, what you've seen at these town halls, would you say that overall you're fairly confident that whoever we end up with through this primary, if they become president, that you can trust them on this issue?
I don't think so. I don't think so far we have all the information and commitments and demonstration that we have a candidate who is prepared to fight for the Green New Deal. But we are happy with all the candidates that have been sort of framing their climate plans around the Green New Deal. And ultimately, we're going to trust the candidates that's the most committed and capable of passing a Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. And so that means laying out an ambitious plan and having the political will to achieve it. Specifically, Bernie, we totally appreciate his plan. It's the most aggressive and comprehensive plan, and it grasps the challenge while recognizing the opportunity we have to transform our economy. But he hasn't committed to abolishing the filibuster. So that's a little challenging there, because how can we, you know, trust a candidate to pass the Green New Deal if they don't necessarily have the political will to achieve it? We don't know what the Congress is going to look like in 2020. Hopefully, it looks blue, but you never know.
Yeah, I think that that's a great point. I think that having the right position is important, but having the will and the strategy to put it into effect is important too. And look, we know that Mitch McConnell is likely to still be there. He says that this is one of the forms of legislation that he's going to make it his job to kill. So let's say, best case scenario, a Democrat wins in 2020, they push for the Green New Deal, and hey, what do you know, the Senate's stopping it. What can you do? It's really difficult. We don't have a majority there. What is your reaction going to be if that comes to pass?
Well, we're thinking about the next year right now. Mm-hmm. And we have to acknowledge that a lot of our strategy is relying on having a progressive and climate committed party that is going to be taking over in 2020. But as far as our scope goes here, we are committed to just laying the groundwork for the Green New Deal in the next year. And so our role in this movement is really bridging between protest, between organizing, and between electoral politics to make sure that in 2020, we're going to have done our best effort, and we're going to have done everything we could have done to put leaders in power who aren't taking money from the fossil fuel industry, who believe that we need to hold fossil fuel executives accountable for the damage they have done and the climate denialism they have promoted. For essentially, you know, reversing all of the damage that Trump has done in the past 2 years as it relates to environmental policy and as it relates to jobs and income inequality.
So I also noticed today, I don't know if you saw, but Representative Joe Kennedy III, who's primarying Ed Markey, he tweeted some nice words about Greta Thunberg and what she's been saying. And I saw that the Sunrise Movement Twitter account criticized him, understandably so, because he is primarying co-sponsor of the Green New Deal, and he is also fairly heavily invested in fossil fuels himself. I'm assuming that you consider the stance on this issue, an actual commitment to passing a Green New Deal, to be a deal breaker if they don't have that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's totally fair to say. But at the same time, you know, merely saying you support a Green New Deal doesn't cut it. I think that so many candidates like Kennedy and like the Democratic presidential candidates we see today support it shows how much momentum we've gained. But at the same time, you know, you have to have the plans that are aggressive and that are ambitious and not merely plans that are aiming, like Joe Biden, that are aiming to bring down our emissions, but at the same time aren't banning fracking. And it's sort of like having that controversial component there is something that's developed recently, because before we were told that the Green New Deal wouldn't have catapulted in the way that it has. And now that it has, it's like, okay, we have to be looking at these plans tooth and nail, seeing if they actually align with what the original resolution calls for.
I couldn't agree more. I want to ask you one other question. This is a little bit oddball. I want to ask you for advice, because I know that a lot of activists, I've heard this recently, actually, Greta has talked about this at the UN, about the media focusing on individuals in some cases, like focusing on her as an individual, which I know I have been guilty of, just because I need something to inspire me to go on in what can be a very dark career. But I'm curious, as a climate activist, what can the media be doing that would actually be helpful to your efforts? What can they do? What perhaps should they not be doing?
I think telling stories is a really powerful way of showing the potential we have to create a better society, to improve the well-being of people these days who work three jobs and who are struggling to get by. The story of the Green New Deal in and of itself is a really inspirational story to tell. And it requires some creative component to it, right? Because we don't have the plan actually at the scale anywhere in the world that we can look today. Mm-hmm. So I think definitely focusing on those stories, but then also focusing on personal stories of people who are on the front lines of this crisis, who, you know, may not have the time to be advocating for the climate crisis like I do and like Greta does, but who are actually experiencing the effects of it every day, and sort of what sort of emotions does that elicit in the audience. Greta is extremely inspiring. And she is an extremely powerful speaker, but at the same time, you know, it's what's happening. We're not the UN today. They're proposing climate pledges, but they don't actually have any plan to deal with fossil fuel corruption and influence in politics.
Yeah.
So it's like, how far really is her message going to go if we are, you know, just focusing on how inspiring she is? Like she said, she doesn't want the empathy. She wants to see action. She wants to see plans.
Okay, I appreciate that advice. Gonna do my best here. Zena Prector Rodriguez, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate everything you do.
Thank you, I really appreciate it.
We're gonna take a short break here. We come back, we're gonna be joined by Representative Ro Khanna to talk about the effort to weed out some of the bad apples in the Democratic caucus after this. There's almost nothing you can do in the modern Democratic Party that will draw the ire of the leadership more so than endorsing a primary challenger to a Democratic incumbent. And that is perhaps why we have seen so few willing to step up and actually do that. But there are a few, and we're joined now on the show by a great example of this. Congressman Ro Khanna, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hi, John.
It's great to have you here. So you recently made some endorsements. You were willing to endorse challengers to some incumbent Democrats. That is a big step in the current political context. Why did you feel that you should do that?
Well, I endorsed Marie Newman over Dan Lipinski. It was a simple choice. Marie is pro-choice. Dan Lipinski is not. Dan Lipinski opposed the Affordable Care Act. He voted against the Affordable Care Act when President Obama was there. Mary Newman supports Medicare for all. And Dan Lipinski has been anti-LGBTQ equality. He has not been supportive of the Dreamers. So I don't understand how, frankly, he's a Democrat.
Yeah, it seems like those would be considered bigger sins than endorsing a primary challenger. And so you've put out a call for more to do this. Is that mainly aimed at some of your progressive colleagues, or do you feel like centrists can also potentially step up and weigh in on some of these primary challenges?
I think this is such an easy one. Every Democrat who believes that you should be pro-choice, that you should believe in LGBTQ equality, who supports the Affordable Care Act. You don't even have to be like me supporting Medicare for all. Everyone who just believes we need some form of affordable health care should be supporting Marie Newman. Dan Lipinski was one of the biggest thorns in the side of President Obama. So I don't understand how, unless you don't believe in what Obama did, I don't understand how you can vote for Dan Lipinski or support Dan Lipinski.
You know, I recently read a profile of Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez that said that she had sort of been taught how things work in DC, and thus you can expect that she'll probably do less endorsing of, for instance, Justice Democrats in the future. You've been in Congress for a little bit longer. Can we expect that as the primary season continues, you might have more endorsements of primary challengers?
Yes, absolutely. I have an open mind. I've done it last cycle. I got into trouble, of course, famously for endorsing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez after I had already endorsed Crowley because I was impressed by her. I was the only one in the entire Congress to endorse her. And I have endorsed a number of challengers and will continue to do so where I think a better progressive would represent the scene. Here's the hypocrisy. There was no one saying to Joe Kennedy, who's challenging from the right, Ed Markey, don't run against Ed Markey. Ed Markey's been the leader on climate change. And yet Joe Kennedy didn't get any pushback because of the establishment.
Exactly. I want to ask you just a question about some more relatively breaking news. I know that earlier today, Representative John Lewis called formally for Donald Trump to be investigated for potential impeachment on the House floor. There's a lot of concerns about this developing Ukraine story. What is your position on all this?
Well, it's appalling. I mean, you have the president of the United States basically browbeating a foreign leader, threatening to withhold foreign aid to investigate their own political rival. I had long ago called for impeachment proceedings. They need to happen starting tomorrow aggressively. And we need to have a vote on the House. It's not enough to just say, okay, let's have the proceedings. I mean, the proceedings could be endless. We need a commitment by the leadership to have a vote by the end of the year.
I certainly agree. I know that I believe the count is now up to at least 153, if not 155, of your colleagues in the House and the Democratic side now support impeachment. I'm curious, I know that you've been pushing it forward for some time, many have. At a certain point, if the evidence of criminality is so clear, unconstitutional behavior is so clear, is that a potential cause for questioning the continuing leadership of the Democratic caucus?
Well, I think the speaker today, my guess is, let's say we have a 4 o'clock meeting, will announce that we are going to go into a formal impeachment proceeding. And I hope she will make a commitment that we bring a vote. But I definitely think if she doesn't bring a vote, that is a legitimate grounds to criticize her. I don't see how she wouldn't be able to bring a vote at this point with John Lewis and Adam Schiff and so many members supporting it.
I share that same hope. I suppose we'll have to see as the day continues. Representative Rokana, as always, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
I appreciate it. I appreciate your having me on. I just stepped outside the Capitol, so I apologize for the tourists, but I wanted to do the show.
No, always glad to have you on and keep doing what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, the topic of impeachment. Many have said that Donald Trump secretly wants to be impeached. We're gonna go to the expert on the topic. What does Donald Trump think about that after this? Throughout this year, as Democratic leadership have been attempting to tamp down expectations about any sort of impeachment proceedings or even investigation against Donald Trump, one of the big tools, one of the big narratives that they've used is the idea that no, don't impeach him. He secretly wants that. That's actually what he wants. He wants to be attacked. Thus, he can defend himself. So if you start some sort of investigation, if you impeach him, it will only make him grow ever more powerful. That has always seemed a little bit ridiculous, a little too clever for me. That's seven-dimensional chess there. But look, I'm not the expert. Let's turn to an expert on the idea. Would a president ever want to be impeached? We turn now to Donald Trump.
Listening to them say, oh, he'd love to be impeached. He'd love to be impeached. He'd love to see the government shut down. You know, whenever it comes to something like the catastrophe that just happened with executive action. He'd love to see all the Democrats. I mean, they must be coached. They must go to school for this. He'd love to be impeached. Please impeach him. It would be so good for the Democrats. please shut down the government. It would be so good for Obama. That's what they want, shut down the government. What a lot of crap. Because all what they're doing, they're actually talking the Republicans into not doing. Do you think Obama seriously wants to be impeached and go through what Bill Clinton did? He would be a mess. He would be thinking about nothing but it would be a horror show for him. It would be an absolute embarrassment. It would go down on his record permanently. But they're saying, oh, he'd love to be impeached. That would be so good. And the Republicans are all saying, oh, we'd never impeach him. We'd never impeach him because he'd like that.
Well,
and the Republicans, and I'm a Republican, and the Republicans are saying on the other hand about, you know, about the other shutting down.
Okay, so that was Donald Trump back in, I believe it was November 24th, 2014. Credit to Parker Malloy, one of the best news hounds in the business. She tracked down this clip. And yeah, look, he's an idiot and a buffoon, and we're gonna get to that in just a second. But he's not necessarily wrong there. Like, that sort of argument is very self-serving from the president's point of view, if it helps to dissuade people from on the opposite side from actually thinking seriously about impeachment. Now, obviously, the stuff they were talking about at that time, being impeachable offenses, was ridiculous. It was a weird ball of hair and right-wing conspiracy theories. But the idea does stand. And look at what Donald Trump said there. He'd be thinking about nothing but it would be a horror show, an embarrassment, it would be permanently on his record. That was what Donald Trump thought about that. Now, Donald Trump's not talking about that now, but he hasn't had a new thought in 30 years. That's still bouncing around in that orange dome. And so the idea that he wouldn't want to be impeached is absurd. It would be a disaster for him. Now, that's not why the Democrats should do it. They shouldn't be considering either his psychology or sort of electoral partisan consequences. They should be considering whether or not he has committed impeachable offenses and whether or not it's risen to the point where they have to do their constitutional duty by impeaching him. I would argue that we are long past that point, but more and more evidence comes out every single day. I do want to turn to one more video though, just give an idea of how prepared Donald Trump is for the impeachment process. Listen to what he said back in 2014.
Has the president done something worthy of impeachment, and should he be impeached?
Well, he certainly did something that was unconstitutional. Now, it depends on a Justice Roberts if he wants to just curry favor in the Beltway like he did with Obamacare, because that's the only reason he did it, because he knows he was wrong. But it certainly depends on what happens. I mean, I think certainly he could be impeached, and certainly they could shut down.
In 2014, and I believe still, he thinks that the Supreme Court is the body that does impeachment. It's a court, I guess it has to be, right? It's like you have your day in court. He thinks that. Like, he was like 4 months from declaring that he was running for the presidency, and he has no idea what is in our Constitution. That's not the most important thing, but it is something to bear in mind. Now, we are waiting on pins and needles for a meeting later on and word from the Democratic leadership. Are they finally going to move on impeachment? I don't know. My expectations are subterranean at this point, but the numbers are swelling. John Lewis had very powerful comments earlier today about why the time had come. And you know, someone who's been long been right on this issue, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she tweeted earlier, "Yes, this is an emergency. We don't have the luxury of time with another committee. Judiciary has been investigating and putting the pieces together for months. Impeachment belongs there. We must honor jurisdiction, historical precedent, and work done, and allow judiciary to move forward." So she appears to share some of the concerns that Representative Rokana was sharing with us, that even if it seemed like they were moving towards impeachment, setting up a brand new select committee could just be another sophisticated way of kicking the can down the road. And so watch out for that. But as of right now, it is possible that today there will finally be some movement on this issue. And if that is the case, then as much as it pains me, I have to quote Cenk Uygur by saying, tick, 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 tick. So we'll see about that. Again, manage your expectations, people. This is a Democratic Party after all. Really fast, I just wanna say one of the great reviews on iTunes for the Damage Report podcast from Slunkmaster 5000 was hard-hitting reporting of news that's important to you. John reports on the things that have an impact on your life, assuming you're one of the 99%. Thank you, Slunkmaster. That's very nice of you to say. We love every review and rating that you guys put in. It's super important for getting this podcast out to more people. Hard to do it otherwise, so we'd appreciate you contributing to that effort. Lots more planned for the rest of the week. We will see you tomorrow morning.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.